Hi guys. You will notice that this isn't the normal podcast intro that I do. I'm not going to necessarily play the theme song or give bit intros or have Kristen and I bantering about different announcements. This is last week we took the a week off of the podcast. There was things going on around the world, and more specifically in the United States that sort of means that we have to leave room for those conversations to take place and for people to be able to process all of that information, including ourselves. But this week, I did not necessarily want to take another week off because I thought it would be good for us to come back and to talk about different things. And just so happens that we have a great episode that I recorded a few weeks back with my friend David Guthrie. And David is a really interesting guy. I actually He was my professor at architecture school a long time ago, a long time ago. And he is a really interesting guy and has taken some on something that we thought was very appropriate for this episode, which is to basically address the issues of people's safety during the pandemic and how he's going to try to help that through design and through his connections in the design world and in the fashion world and helping with people making masks and all those different ideas there. So very exciting that David is doing that. I'm really happy that people are looking at what he's doing at that time. We talk a lot about my education and about where I came from, which, sort of helped me become the person that I am today. And it was because of people like David who have helped me see a lot in myself. And I think that's something we can all do and give back to our communities by teaching and by giving people things that they need in their lives. So I really appreciate David coming on, and I thought it was very appropriate for him to be part of this. And that's what I think we should all be doing, is helping each other out and doing a lot that we can to make ourselves better people, just like David's doing. So with that being said, hopefully you guys are safe and you are healthy, and you are also free to express yourself in the way that you want to be expressing yourself. So hopefully you guys will enjoy this podcast with Mr. David Guthrie.
Well, let's first talk about when we first knew each other.
Are you recording?
Yeah, I'm recording. That was 93.
Three.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
It was.
It was my first year in architecture school, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I didn't know anything about anything.
I was a first year professor.
Yeah.
So I was in the same boat. I was, 3 years out of school, not even 3 years out of school.
Right. Were you a
And
classmate with Shisha at school?
she was a year behind me,
She
I
was a year
think.
behind. Okay. Right.
Or maybe, I mean, it's a little confusing because I took 5 years to do the 3 year or 3.5 year program.
Okay.
I did 2 years, and then I was in the Mark One like you,
Yeah.
right? And I did 2 years, and then I left school to go work,
Okay.
to get some experience in the real world.
Yeah, sure.
I was pretty disappointed or disillusioned with what I was being exposed to at school,
Okay.
to the point where I was thinking, like, this isn't for me, maybe.
Like architecture wasn't for you, right?
Well, I mean, my whole life, that's what I aspired to
Really?
do. It kind of, it couldn't, since I was like 7 years old, and it was this idea that was constant. I tried video and film production, which I loved, and photography, but
Yeah.
I had this nagging voice back there, architecture. You got to do architecture.
Okay.
And I originally had planned to go to study architecture as an undergrad, but I had this conflict with athletics,
Right. You're a big swimmer.
with swimming,
Yeah.
and it was something that was, I had never really done anything in swimming, but it was a dream.
Right.
And so the plan was to go to, I was in Arkansas, went to high school in Arkansas, and I decided to go to Hendricks College, which is a really good liberal arts college, tiny little school, which did not offer architecture. And so I was going to transfer to the University of Arkansas, In their program, the first year you're not in design studio, you're just taking general courses, pre-architecture. Right. So I'll do my pre-architecture at Hendrix, then I'll transfer.
Okay.
So it got to be time to transfer, like after 2 years, and I applied, I was all ready to go, and then I was like, I think 17, no, I was 18 years old. Uh-huh. And I could just see, I looked at the curriculum, it was all architecture, and I thought, I'm not ready to sign up for exclusively architecture, you know,
right,
for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to finish at Hendrix, get a liberal arts degree.
Yeah.
And then at that point, I was kind of making a pretty big decision because I didn't know anything about the Mark I programs.
Right.
I didn't know they existed. So I thought, man, if you do this, you're going to have to start over and get another bachelor's degree.
Right.
But I was just getting into upper level courses and I was loving that path. Mm-hmm. So with 2 years left, I had to come up with a major in a hurry, something that I could finish.
Yeah. What did you come up with?
Well, it's kind of interesting. My dad was a psychiatrist.
Oh, okay.
I'd been around, you know, psychiatry my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I had taken a few psych classes that I really enjoyed. I went and met with one of my professors when I was making this decision. Like, you know, what do I do so that I can finish on time?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, what I would do, I would major in psychology and do the minimum. And that,
okay.
So I took him to heart. That's exactly what I did. So it didn't have a very demanding workload in terms of the number of courses you needed. Plus, mm-hmm. I already had a few. So it gave me the most latitude. The whole point was to take courses I was interested in and anything I wanted to take.
Right.
So if I had picked another major, I would have had to load up on one thing, which mm-hmm. was that kind of, you know, monolithic diet was what I was trying to avoid.
Right.
So I picked psychology and then I, you know, just took things that I was interested in.
Right.
And it rubbed some of the other psychology professors the wrong way.
Yeah. Because everyone else was being serious about psychology and you were just like, I'm just getting this to get a degree.
I didn't go around broadcasting that.
No, sure, yeah, sure.
I wasn't committed. And it's... I remember clearly the award ceremony, when I was about to graduate. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I went to one. In 4 years, I never went to the convocation for the awards.
Right.
And I sat there while all these other people went up and got awards. I didn't deserve anything.
Right.
I didn't do anything. And I didn't like that at all. It's like, this is not going to happen again.
Right.
So when I finally did go to graduate school,
mm-hmm.
I went there with a mission, you know?
Yeah.
And took it very seriously.
Yeah. Well, you took design very seriously. I remember that very specifically. And I remember because I was, you know, I was coming from, not dissimilar from you, right? Because I'm coming into architecture school and I knew about the MR program. And that's kind of what I did up at design. It's like, yes, I want to be an architect, but I want to get a degree in other things as much as possible and learn as much as I can before I start to dive into architecture. And this was actually recommended to me by someone who was an architect who sort of advised me as a friend of the family. He was a kind of a nice architect and he said, oh, that's what you should do. And so I said, okay. So, you know, math and architect, math and fine arts. And I did all that. And I sort of went into architecture school, say, let's make some buildings. I don't even know what that meant, you know? And then, you know, just being in a studio was a different idea, right? Studio was a very, I was used to going to classrooms, learning things, doing homework, writing papers. And like, no, you're going to spend 8 hours in one room every day. And then you're going to be... Yeah. And
that's day. And then the night, 8 hours at night.
Yeah. You're just going to be here all the time and around your classmates and constantly making things. And I was very different way of thinking. And the thing that I think I remember the most about talking to you and Michael as well, it was you and Michael... is that I had this thing that I needed to you presented me a problem and I had to have a solution to that problem, and that had to give a solution that was the only correct answer, because that's the way I learned it in math, right? Like, here's the problem, here's the solution. And you're like, it could be anything, Chris. And then you just sort of made me think about that process, as well as crafting. Craft was a big thing about making sure that, you know, when I was drawing or when I was doing things, I was actually presenting my ideas in a very clear, concise, and well, you know, constructed manner.
Yeah, the process, the quality of the process is just as important as the final product.
Right.
It is a product, especially when you're in school. You don't realize the final thing.
Right.
In most cases. But that is why I started the Cube class, which was after you. I think I started that maybe that spring semester.
Okay.
94. And then it developed from there for decades.
Right.
2005, I published a book, 2004, 2005. Did you ever see that book?
No, I didn't.
The little back black cube book.
Well, explain to people what the Cube book is, what the Cube project was.
You know, you kind of have to go. I mean, we can go back as far as you want.
Sure. we got lots of time.
You know, thinking about this, before we talk about that, I want to talk about our experience.
Yeah.
Because when. When I finished graduate school, I had the privilege of opting out of doing a studio or a thesis.
Okay.
I was back in the day where you could, you know, in your final semester, you had a choice. You could just do a design studio, you could do a thesis, or you could do an independent project.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone off on a traveling fellowship for a semester.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came back, I was ready to really do an independent project.
Mm-hmm.
The first week of school, I kind of took a step back.
And okay.
I thought, you know, I'm dealing with so much stuff. I'm not sure if I should take on an independent project. I'll just jump in a studio. I'll just take the easy path. And I had seen enough around the school to know all you have to do is show up that last semester. I mean, you could literally pin up a few pieces of blank trace and everybody would kind of nod and say, well, there's not very much here, and you get your degree, you know?
Yeah.
There weren't consequences at that point.
Yeah.
The work had already been done. Nobody was going to stop me from getting my degree. So,
right.
Peter Waldman was at the school, and I had never taken one of his studios, and I really wanted to. So mm-hmm. I jumped in his studio and I set up my desk, and I just couldn't do it.
Mm.
That the previous year, I had sort of graduated from that. You know, I had done the studio thing, and I was ready for something else. So I tried it. I just couldn't do it. And so I apologized to him. I was like, I'm sorry. I got to find my own path now. That's mm-hmm. my transition from school to my professional life.
Right.
So I decided I was going to do a competition, kind of fold a competition into my independent project and try to make some money.
Mm-hmm.
The Wood Institute had nice prizes, and prizes were great. You know, they let me travel, that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I did the Wood Institute competition, or that was the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it's scheduled, you don't get to start on the project the first week of school. There's a compressed time frame for that project, and it started about 3 weeks into the semester. So I had needed to do something for those first few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to kind of study joinery.
Right.
And I'm thinking that that's going to find its way into this Wood Institute competition, the part in the whole, et cetera.
Right.
So I started thinking about making these connections, taking wood, making connections, and dovetails and, you know, beautiful joints, mortise and tenon, et cetera, and thinking about Japanese joinery, those kinds of things. And it just didn't resonate with me at all because there was no context. So it's like it doesn't matter if it's a little, I mean, it's a paperweight.
Right.
So I decided I needed a context. So I got a chair, a wooden chair. Mm-hmm. And my plan was to saw it in half and then mend it with a dovetail, like create this kind of zipper yep. down the middle. And I got the chair like at a, you know, junk shop. And first of all, I had to find a chair that was worth my time.
Okay.
The starting point, you know, let's say the final chair wasn't going to really be able to be better than the original chair.
Right.
In a way. I needed the right context. So I found a Bank of England chair, and really interesting, I started to kind of scrutinize it, and I didn't know where to start. And I think that that's a really important thing in architecture, in any design project or process, is to embrace that arbitrary moment.
Right.
Could circle back around to kind of what you were talking about of being sure and knowing that that's the answer.
Right.
Well, what's the question? You know, first of all, what is the question? And there's in every project, there's the arbitrary. It's the same in filmmaking.
Right.
You just have to make a decision and go, and then you respond to what's happening.
Right.
And you may have an idea, but no matter what, you're going to encounter the arbitrary.
Right, right,
and
right.
And so I just embraced that. So I couldn't figure out a logic for how to approach this chair. And,
right.
So that first one, I just, as I kind of studied it and scrutinized it, I found that it appeared to be made out of like three or four pieces of wood.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look closely, each one of those was made up of, but disguised to look like a single piece. And so
right.
I thought, you know, there's a value judgment embedded in that, you know, but a large piece of wood, single piece, is more valuable.
Yes.
Than a built up piece. things that we don't really think about are in the objects around us, you know. So I thought, I'm gonna search for all of those suppressed joints and expose them. So
mm-hmm.
that first chair, I had no idea I was going to talk about chairs, but that first chair was all about disassembling it through those joints, all of those joints, and then reassembling it. But
right.
when I put it back together, it was offset. Everything was a little disheveled. So it expressed that all of those connections that had been hidden were now revealed.
Right.
So there wasn't much added. It was really just reconfiguring what was there. And part of what the idea that kind of evolved from that was that first chair is called the contrapposto chair.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, contrapposto is that breakthrough in sculpture that went from the rigid symmetrical form to the form with the shifted weight, where the weight shifts to one leg.
Yep.
And it sets off a series of counter moves. Your hips tilt and then your shoulders tilt the opposite direction.
Right.
And it breathes life into the stone.
Right.
So that was a turning point in Greek art. And the chair that I started with was kind of that rigid symmetrical thing. And I decided, let's make that kind of the contrapposto, the asymmetry.
Right.
So I kind of twisted the chair, moved the back. So it accommodates an asymmetrical seating position, which is more real, right?
Sure.
So what was interesting was that all of the components were still, the symmetry was still readable, was still legible in that object, but it was disheveled.
Right, right, right.
And then from there, I did three more chairs, and they involved prosthesis.
Yeah, I remember.
So I cut away chunks with metal components that I fabricated in the machine shop.
Yeah.
And that was really kind of the in a way the first work. And needless to say, I didn't do the Wood Institute competition that semester. This right. other idea just took over.
Right.
It was very strange. It was very polarizing in the school. So, for example, when I left Waldman Studio and I needed a space to work, the logical place was to go into the thesis studio.
Right.
And there's always students that are finishing up from the previous semester that are there and clearing out. So I talked to one of them. And she said, yeah, you can have my space. I'm out of here in a few days. Well, okay. I got called into the dean's office like, no, you're not going in there.
Okay.
Why? So they said, no, you're going to set up in room 215 in the corner by the sink. And I'm like, what? So I went up there and that semester there was an empty studio
okay.
on the second floor, one of the undergrad studios, because I don't know, they had a small class. And so that was like the exile studio. There were two other undergrads that sort of rebelled against their studios and just
right.
set up camp. So in this huge, it was probably the largest studio in the school. We occupied three of the four corners.
Okay.
But it was just bizarre. Like, why couldn't I be... I wanted to be around other students and feed off of that energy and
sure.
have discussions and, you know, do my work. So I ended up being isolated, except I had these two undergrads who were... kind of perfect roommates. They
right.
They were awesome. So it was a great semester. I kind of took what I learned. I worked at Morphosis during that time when I left school after my second year.
Yeah.
I moved to LA and worked at Morphosis, and I learned so much.
I've had Tom Main on this podcast.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. He's actually, their office is actually like two blocks from our office in Culver City. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about him often. And I learned so much in a short amount of time working there. And part of it was what we already mentioned, the infusing everything you do with the same level of commitment.
Yeah.
Like, that is your signature. That's your identity.
Mm-hmm.
The working drawings, like the working drawings that came out of that office were gorgeous.
Right.
And if you're touching those drawings, you're serious. You don't, you know, they're kind of sacred.
Yeah.
And so everybody had that attitude. Everybody mm-hmm. that walked into that culture acclimated really quickly. It was such a strange experience because, you know, I had only had 2 years of school,
mm-hmm.
very little exposure to architecture. And so I started it as an intern and came in with the group for the summer. And about a month or two into the summer, they said, so I had already decided I'm taking off a year from school.
Okay.
I'm just going to stay out here and work. So Tom came to my desk and he said, so you're staying this fall, right? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, okay, because we're thinking about putting you on a project.
Mm.
And I had started this thing called a Drodel, which was a hybrid drawing model.
Okay.
So it became a series, but I did the first one. And it was
okay.
this house in Santa Barbara called the Crawford House.
Yeah.
It was insane. So I was in the shop working on, well, first I had to figure out the whole process, the whole methodology to do this drawing model. I mean, you know their work.
Yeah, right? Yeah, of course.
And this was like 1987 when
yeah.
it was pre-computer.
Yeah.
So all of that stuff that they produce then looks like it's computer generated.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
It was so prescient. In fact, it would be a little bit challenging to do it on a computer now, but mm-hmm. it definitely kind of anticipated that.
Right.
But those projections, the layered drawings, multivalent, like plan and section simultaneous.
Yep.
And they really liked to use the oblique section.
Yep.
Which is beautiful. So it was just sausage.
The drawings were works of art. I mean, honestly, a lot of them. I mean, and even when they started doing CG stuff, it was incredible. I've always admired them because they were so. I mean, there's obviously, you know, if you think about that, sort of the fundamental people of deconstructivism at that time, right? I mean, they're really, and they were all kind of right next to each other. You had basically the Frank Gehry, and you had Tom Main, and you had Eric Owen Moss, right? And they're all kind of right in that area around that time.
It was Southern California. Yeah. It was ground zero.
Ground zero
for
that.
No question about it.
And but one of the things that I always appreciated specifically about Tom Main and about Morphosis is the fact that, you know, coming from the CG side of things, is they looked, when they started to take into advantage, realize what CG was, it was like a natural process for them. It was like, okay, well, now it's
they
just...
They were
ready. They were ready for it. It's like, we'll bring it in and we'll use it as another way to express something. I mean, I think Tom even mentioned it on the podcast. Like, it's really easy to make a sphere on a computer. It's really hard to model one. So sometimes it's better to do it on, do the sphere on a computer, right? So,
yeah, do you remember the David Hockney work? I mean, we were kind of working in this mode when I was in graduate school, mm-hmm. using the Xerox machine, the copy machine, as a real creative tool,
mm-hmm.
To do photo montages,
yeah,
to build up images, manipulate images. And David Hockney around that time did a bunch of work,
uh-huh.
like with fax machines and, you know, printers and layering.
Mm-hmm.
Really using this as a creative tool in ways that people hadn't thought of. And Morphosis was just like that. Like, whatever it is, we're maxing it out.
Right.
We're gonna max out its potential.
So they were one of the first people to use 3D printers that I remember in architecture. And one of the things I remember they did is the 3D printer they used at the time was something called a Z-Corp printer, which actually uses plaster. So it makes a 3D printed plaster thing. And they would print whatever they designed the computer. And it was like, but that wasn't the end. Then they would take it because it was plaster. They would sculpt the plaster itself and change it again. But then this time was an analog as opposed to digital change. So it was really kind of cool.
Amazing. I mean, they did... So much of what they did had never really been seen before.
Mm-mm.
Like, they did huge models, like for the Cedar-Sinai Cancer Center.
Mm-hmm.
You could walk around, and the model was taller than a person.
Yep.
And it came apart, you know?
Yep.
They had the modeling paste technique. Do you mm-hmm. remember that? So they did, you know, they would kind of take one element of the model, like the structure, and make that a contrast in color, and everything else is completely monochromatic.
Mm-hmm.
With that kind of mottled, cloudy, beautiful, like Venetian stucco kind of texture to it. Just gorgeous. They did so many things that influence everything that's come out.
Right.
That was my salvation, you know, because I was at the end of my second, or it was like spring break, my second year.
Yeah.
And I was very disillusioned. You have to imagine 1986, 87, postmodernism held the high ground. That's all everybody was doing and talking about. And I was like, I couldn't digest it. I couldn't embrace it. It didn't resonate. And I'm trying to, you know, you're trying to do good work. And I had no real reference point.
Right.
I remember one visit to the library, I found a book that had some images of Frank Gehry's own house. And I was like, what?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. This is interesting. And that spring, the MFA, the Fine Arts Museum here in Houston, had a lecture series that was the Southern California School.
Okay.
So it was Michael Rotundi, who was Tom Main's partner.
Yep.
And co-founder of Morphosis,
mm-hmm.
Eric Moss,
mm-hmm.
and Frank Gehry.
Oh, that's it. That's it. Those are the guys.
And so I'm in heaven.
Right.
It's like, that's what I want to do. That's okay. I can sink my teeth into that.
Yep.
I want to do this. So after Michael's lecture, I walked up and introduced myself and I said, hey, I want to work for you. What do I have to do?
Yeah.
And he said, well, come out and interview. And the next week was spring break, so I quickly put together a portfolio and got on a plane and off I went.
Right.
And then when I was out there, I spent the week out there, and I did interview with Morphosis, and it did not go well. I interviewed with Tom Main, and he just like, he took my portfolio, and it was like a flip book, just went. And really look at it. And and one of my favorite projects was something I did with Shotgun Houses. And you know, I basically took my cues from what they've done in Galveston, which is they treat them almost like mobile homes.
Yep. We should explain what a shotgun house is, because a lot of people may not, even Americans may not even know what a shotgun house is, but we have a lot of Europeans and stuff. It's kind of an unusual prototype of a house or archetype, I mean.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you ask that, because here it's just a given. When you're in the area of New Orleans, Houston, the Gulf Coast, it's ubiquitous. It's everybody knows what that is. But you're right, if you're not in this area, you may have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But a shotgun house was designed for this climate, for the humid, swampy climate.
Mm-hmm.
So the houses are raised up off the ground. They're not slab on grade. They're on footings, on piers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the air can circulate underneath. And they're just kind of a tube that's sausaged into rooms. So it gets its name because if you shot a shotgun from the front door, it would go all the way out through the back door.
Right.
And it would pass through every room. It's just a linear series of rooms, a very, very simple.
With no hallway.
Full.
Yeah.
So the thing about them is they're linear, which gives them a very small footprint in terms of the facade on the street. They're tiny, but they're long. So they have a lot of depth, but no width. And what that does socially, you know, for the urban design kind of result of that, is you get high density. And they typically have front porches, and you have a little postage stamp front yard with a little 3-foot tall picket fence. And these are all very, very important cues. And they were very important for the social life of these neighborhoods. Everybody lived on their front porches. It's a very kind of socially interactive arrangement. It's kind of what we're systematically erasing now as we tear these houses down and build new. It's basically a garage door, no porch. There's no inner kind of buffer or transition from the inside to the street. You're either in or out.
Right.
So we've kind of erased the idea of life on the street.
Or it's the porch. The front porch is gone.
That's that kind of mediating zone,
right,
where you're in the picture, right? You have a viewing platform in a way for life,
mm-hmm,
for communal life. And so, and even that little picket fence, I mean, you could step over those fences. So they're not security fences, they're more conceptual. It's just marking a little boundary, but it's not in a way designed to keep you out, you know.
Right.
So it's a very communal way of organizing a city, and I live in a neighborhood that's bungalows, you know, in Montrose.
Mm-hmm.
So we still have a lot of these front porches, but with air conditioning and television, et cetera, people don't spend much time in that zone between the front door and the street. But it's one of the real blessings of this pandemic is that life is back, you know?
Yeah.
The other time I experienced that was when we had a hurricane come through. I think it was Ike, took out a lot of trees and a lot of power lines. So our neighborhood was without power for 10 days, and it was the best 10 days of the last 10 years. It was amazing.
Right.
How we just became a community. Because,
mm-hmm,
you know, you have no freezer, your meat's going bad. So everybody was grilling. And by the way, I haven't seen any of your briskets lately.
Yeah, I know. I haven't had a brisket in a while.
But it was great. As long as you've got a bottle of wine and
yeah.
a grill. It was just a beautiful life. And I mean, there was one time it was sort of like a, in a way, a party every night, but not like a crazy party, just gathering mm-hmm. and having a, you know, this kind of social interaction. And we took a vote one night, you know, who wants the power back on? It's like, nope, nobody. Sure enough, as soon as the power came back on, all of that kind of transparency, all the communal kind of life just got sucked back indoors and sealed off.
Right.
But, you know, I think that's one of the things that this pandemic is helping us reconnect with.
Mm-hmm.
It is certainly, I mean, you and I agree with it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we're learning is how much we can accomplish sitting at a computer in isolation.
Right.
You know, it's not a time to despair. It's a time to get creative. It's amazing what you can accomplish sitting at your desk.
Yeah.
Just by connecting with all of, I mean, it's basically a product of all of the relationships you've cultivated in your life.
Sure.
Now is when the real value is really emerging. You know, I've gotten involved with the PPE stuff, and all of that is because of networking through trusted friends. The people that you respect and admire and really trust is who you have to depend on. There's no time to vet. There's no time to build that relationship. So what we're doing is kind of literally networking through the solid relationships that we have, the people that, you know, the people that I know and have faith in, that mm-hmm. their relationships are solid. So if they vouch for somebody, then I'm good. And that works both ways. I've been introduced to new friends through common friends.
Right.
So it's like, you know, this guy's good, this guy's good.
Right.
And we just like immediately can lower our guard and get busy.
Well, we can skip around a little bit, but I'll tell them a little bit about this thing that you've been doing since this pandemic started. You started this new initiative and you're designing these new masks, which are pretty incredible, as well as other things, obviously. But can you tell a little bit about them and what this is?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm like all over the place.
That's fine. Crazy. This is you are right on. You are right where every one of my podcast guests should be, is all over the place.
I just hope it's coherent.
Yeah. It's good.
It's coherent to me, but I have the whole picture. You're just, you know.
Taking pieces.
Yeah. I train at Rice for swimming. There's a master's group there, which uh-huh. is fantastic. And there's like, I don't know, 200 or 300 swimmers that train there regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, who is a good friend of mine, is an ER nurse. And she recently, about a year ago, moved to New York City. And when this pandemic hit, I was terrified of what she was facing. And
right.
Also, right when the lockdowns, so the wave of lockdowns started moving through the community, I moved my mother from Birmingham to Houston
mm-hmm.
in the middle of that, from one memory care facility to one here.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did it, they were both on lockdown. So it was extraordinary that we were able to pull that off.
Wow.
Yeah, it was March 12th. The place here in Houston, it's called Belmont Village. Mm-hmm. They went on lockdown.
Yeah.
And I thought that there wasn't a lot of urgency to get my mom moved. So to back up a little bit, I think I mentioned my grandfather passed when I was in graduate school, but my dad mm-hmm. passed in February this year.
Oh, sorry.
And we knew that, we were pretty sure that he was going to pass before my mom. Mm-hmm. And my mom and I are really close, and she always wanted to move close to me when my dad was gone. That okay. was always the plan. And she started having memory issues about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a very, very slow decline. And it's, again, it's not a linear thing. It's not an on-off.
Mm-hmm.
It comes and goes. And, you know, last summer I had one of the deepest conversations I've ever had with her.
Right.
You know, at the same time, her short-term memory is, you know, it's not there.
Right, right, right.
But she is still there. So when my dad died, we started making arrangements for her to move to Houston. And she used to always say, I don't want to live with you. Right. I just want to be in a place like this near you. And I was like, Mom, it will happen. We will make this happen. And so I started looking for places and touring and all of that. And I picked one there were a few that were great. And I picked one. We did all the paperwork. We were getting everything ready. And this was in the month of last of February, first part of March. Mm-hmm. And we had paid through March where she was. So there wasn't a lot of urgency. It was like, we just need to get her moved before the end of the month.
Okay.
And I was trying to work it into my schedule too.
Mm-hmm.
Also the doctor, her primary care doctor originally recommended, don't move her right away. It's too much. You know, she was still processing my dad's passing.
Mm-hmm.
And to make that dramatic move at that point can just push them over the edge. It's too much. So he said, let's see how she does. And then we'll, you know, wait a few weeks. So that's kind of also, that was part of my calculus too. So we had everything arranged and I was just getting, you know, trying to pick a weekend that I was going to go get her and bring her to Houston. And then Belmont Village went on lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my God. So this is really getting serious. The worst possible situation would be for her to be isolated, you know, 600-700 miles away with no family
right
around. And no way to change that. So I was like, I got to get this done now. So that was a Thursday that they went on lockdown. On Saturday, I went to Birmingham. When I arrived there, that facility went on lockdown. And fortunately, they made an exception for me to... This is early on when everybody was like sealing things off. And we're talking about, you know, retirement home, nursing home.
Course. Yeah,
which are the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
They made an exception for me to go in and out so I could pack up her stuff and load up her stuff. I have a truck, a pickup mm-hmm. truck, so I was just going to move her myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hit the road on Monday morning and arrived here Monday evening.
Yeah.
There was a miscommunication, and they expected me on Tuesday. So I wasn't on the list for them to let me in.
Right.
But fortunately, we were able to navigate through that, and I was able to move her in and that night and set everything up, unpack everything and get her settled.
Right.
Because after all this time of anticipating her being my neighbor,
mm-hmm.
It finally happens and then I can't see her.
Right.
And I didn't know when I would see her again, so, or be able to really visit again. So I had to make sure that everything was set up exactly, you know, the way that she would want it
mm-hmm.
that night. Anyway, just being in that situation and seeing what was going on in Italy and New York, I sprung into action. I was like, I have to do something to help to protect my mom,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you know, and protect everybody there in that facility.
Sure.
So this is when, you know, nothing was available. You go to the stores and everything was cleaned out.
Yep.
But I went to a hardware store to, you know, do you remember Southland Hardware?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
So it's a mom and pop, like they don't exist anymore. Well, this one does, and okay. you can get anything there. So I went to get some little clamp or something, and mm-hmm. I walk in and there's this little pile of disinfectant and PPE, and I'm like, what? It's like nobody thought to go there.
Right.
For that stuff. And then the guy said, well, I have some masks if you want masks. And so I got these, I think they're called
the N95s.
P95s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. N95 or P97s. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're the respirators
for
spraying pesticides. So they're like the highest filtration level.
Right.
And so I think they had four of them, and I bought them and gave one to a healthcare worker, a caregiver at the facility with for my mom. And mm-hmm. and then I sent one to my friend who's the ER nurse up in New York and mm-hmm. got a face shield and a few other things. And I sent her a note and I said, you know, we're all behind you. The country appreciates you. Mm-hmm. In the days that followed that, I was looking at the TV and seeing these nurses, the New York nurses, just pleading for, you know, we're wearing bandanas. We have no PPE. This is crazy. You've turned your back on us. Mm-hmm. It was just heartbreaking. I was really ashamed, you know, what our country was doing. And so I thought, you know, I sent one thing. That's not even a drop in the bucket.
Right.
So I thought, what else can I do? And so I thought I'll do a fundraiser or GoFundMe or whatever kind of going blank on those. But I was going to do one of those to raise money to bring in a shipment. Found a supplier in San Diego that's a medical device importer mm-hmm. where they work internationally all the time. They had a minimum order number of 1 million. So immediately I'm thinking, okay, we're swinging for the fences here. Why not?
Right.
And that just got me into this whole world that I had never, ever been exposed to or really considered, like supply chain and procurement, all of that stuff. So within a few days, I was on that White House procurement team list. Rachel Battle, who was leading that, who got kind of thrown under the bus. Mm. We were corresponding. Basically, they were vetting everybody. And we kind of know somebody, then you never got a call back.
Okay.
But in those days, everything was changing dramatically every day. It was crazy. And So I had that connection with, it's called Perigee. Perigee is the importer that's based in San Diego, and they had some connections in China, and they're all legit companies. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't get anybody to buy. So we were talking to like the state of Arkansas, some of these state governments, and Stanford University, some of the other California big buyers, and nobody would buy. And basically it's because it's all cash up front.
Okay.
They don't ship anything until it's paid for. Well, that doesn't fit the model of purchasing for any of these institutions. They never do that. I mean, you're lucky to get net 10. Hmm. So that was a big problem early on. All this material was there and nobody would buy it. Meanwhile, it was a feeding frenzy. There were other people just bringing stuff in and paying for it themselves with the hope of, you know, making a profit, reselling and making a profit. But over the next, I don't know, week or two, the pandemic really went world. 200 countries suddenly were competing for this PPE in China. And right. you could not, there was no inventory. If you put your money down, you put your cash on the table, that would buy the next wave of production. Not anything that exists now, but you're buying future production. That's mm-hmm. the way it's working. And things have settled down a little bit since then. But I mean, I was just looking earlier, I guess it was the end of last week, at a proposal for the state of Ohio. They were looking for bids for a large contract. And, you know, none of this works. They're kind of operating in the old reality. And they're completely inflexible
right.
on their terms and things like that. So we're just not able to make much headway on that side. But because I started getting involved with this stuff, I talked to a friend who has a garment factory. And this is sort of by chance. I wanted to, he develops apps, or in the past he's been an app developer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually one of my students briefly,
okay.
Architecture students. He's from Costa Rica, and back in 2001, I taught a 2-week workshop there.
Okay.
And it was probably a dozen students, maybe a few more. And I have a handful of lifelong friends out of that brief workshop.
Nice.
A bunch of the guys were surfers, and I was there for most of the summer. I went for a conference and did this workshop, and then I stayed down there to surf. Mm-hmm. And when these guys were finished with their semester, they're like, hey, you know, we got finals and all of that stuff, but when that's over, let's meet up and go on a safari. So mm-hmm. Excellent. So like 7 or 8 of us hired a couple of little boats and went up to Ollie's Point, which is up on the Nicaraguan border.
Yeah.
And they just dropped us off and said, see you in a week. And it was so much fun. But so we bonded, you know, mm-hmm. people in that group. And a lot has happened in the years since then, but that I had been going to Costa Rica since the early 90s. But I was just kind of, it was kind of hit and run. I didn't have any real ties there. But after that workshop, I was connected to the architecture community. And then I suddenly had like roots there. I had a real social network. And so I've sustained that all these years. And in the intervening years, I've bought property down there. Have dreams of developing that and moving there someday. Hmm. But anyway, this guy was just a savant, you know, just brilliant. And was always, I mean, he was in the generation, this is 2001, so he's in the generation that trained in CG. It's second nature to them. And so he's very good at it, and he's also very good at putting teams together and managing teams of people that know more than he does. So he's got kind of the whole spectrum of abilities as a designer, etc. And anyway, I reached out to him about doing an app, and he had transitioned. He used his skill in software to start doing visual. He built a visualizer for online shopping.
Okay.
And this is like 10 years ago. We were working with a swimsuit manufacturer that's based in Mexico, and design on their website. And so what my friend Derek, what he was working on was a 3D kind of mannequin you can map any pattern onto, any suit pattern. So it's an interactive thing where customers could see the pattern, see the design in 3D, rotate the model. And
mm-hmm.
So he was early on in that. And one thing led to another. He started working for a company that made made-to-order dress shirts and suits. And he just kept evolving this software. So now he has his own, he's built his own A to Z software that is the website and all of the specifications you put in, your dimensions, critical dimensions for your pattern. The pattern gets sent to the factory. It's all automated. It tracks all the material inventory and cost. And these things are produced in a couple of days, like 3 or 4 days.
That's amazing.
And we're talking like Zegna, high-end Italian design houses are using his platform.
Interesting.
And it's amazing. So they're competitive, you know, from a price point.
Right.
Off the rack stuff, if you can get it bespoke, that's amazing. So it's very, very high-end stuff. And this all factors into what I'm doing now, because he has a factory in LA and a factory in Mexico. And in the past, he was working with a factory in China. And these are, listening to your career or your path, it's a little bit similar, you know, teaming up for different projects with different partners. So that's what he's done. And now he's kind of circled back around to China, and he's working with an old contact there. And when I contacted him about doing the app, he was trying to figure out how to save his company. So he's got all these workers, 2 factories he's trying to keep afloat, and nobody's buying clothes. Nobody's ordering clothing. The garment industry is momentarily dead.
Mm-hmm.
So he's scrambling, trying to figure out what to do. So he's pivoting to making PPE. So they started making masks out of fabric and hazmat suits. And he was like, I have this stuff, but I don't know where to sell it. And I was like, well, he was like, you have connections for buyers, so let's team up.
Right.
So we put together a website using his platform. It's called PPE Direct. And the goal was to get to do a ground up, a bottom up approach instead of a top down, because the top down distribution, you know, procurement and distribution was clearly not working. Nursing homes in rural places, clinics in rural communities weren't getting anything. So what we were trying to do is, instead of worrying about these huge orders, let's just let people buy what they need and ship it direct. So that was our original model. So you could buy like 50 N95s and we would send them anywhere you want. We could ship worldwide from the factory in Shanghai. And it didn't work as smoothly as we had hoped. The rules keep changing. Now they won't even let, first of all, commercial flights have stopped.
Right.
And now Trump has made it, has prohibited the carriers like UPS and FedEx from shipping PPE. So
really?
We can still get it. So we can still do it. We can still ship, but not through those carriers, not through regular flights. We can ship on charter flights. So everything that's coming over now is being shipped on charter flights.
Huh.
I mean, it's just an ever-shifting landscape. And it's like trying to see it through a keyhole, you know, when you're
right
here. But we've covered a lot of ground. We've gone through a learning process. You know, one of the first things that I ran into was the first charge on the credit card had a 2-week hold on the payout. I didn't know anything about that. I'd never done this before, but that's standard for a new company.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 2 weeks is just killing me, you know? I didn't have the money to just send the money to China and then get reimbursed myself. So I had to wait for the payout. So there were a couple of other things that happened. Like by the time the money came through, then they were back ordered, and then there was a Chinese holiday for 5 days.
Right.
Anyway, the first products have been delivered. So that's to me, that's a big success. Like, okay, we survived. We ran the gauntlet and we landed material here in this crazy environment.
Right.
It's going to get easier now. We can get stuff delivered in less than 2 weeks. And about half of that time is product sitting in Hong Kong waiting for a flight, waiting for to get on one of these charters, or waiting for the charter to fill up.
Right.
So one of the things that we've done, the factory in China made these designer Italian suits, and they're super high quality. This factory has been around for, I don't know, 17 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And acquired the skilled workers. And I know they have 450 different types of machines. And, you know, they have one person that just is in charge, or maybe more than one, but that's all they do, is they're in charge of machines. The mm-hmm. factory owner doesn't know about the machines. It's way too much.
Right.
But they, half of the, or part of the factory made suits and part of the factory made dress shirts. And so they pivoted to try to survive, you know, because nobody's ordering suits now. She doesn't want to, the factory owner's name is Xiao Mei, and she doesn't want to lose her employees. And, you know, she genuinely cares about them as well. And so she started making hazmat suits in the area that made dress suits, and converted the shirt making part of the factory to making fabric masks. So she's making masks out of this organic Albini cotton. They're gorgeous. And we just got them tested, lab tested.
Mm-hmm.
And we also are bringing in some pharmaceutical grade filter fabric from Turkey. It's the only place where it's manufactured. And it's, I think they make 50 metric tons a month, and she's getting 3 metric tons of that material.
Mm.
So these are going to be kind of hybrid. We might even go for FDA approval. But she's super creative, and she was educated in the United States. So the culture isn't a barrier. The language isn't a barrier. And we're just trying to add value and kind of have it be a win-win, where her factory stays open, her workers are doing something they care about, and we influence what's happening in a positive way.
Right.
So we'll be able to do custom anything. We can do anything. She said, David, you've got a factory in China behind you. What do you want to do?
Wow.
Like,
okay.
That's a dream come true. But one of the first things we're doing is focusing on the masks.
Right.
And we've got several different designs. We've got them for kids. What we're going to start doing is really making them available to companies who want to have, or universities where they can have their brand identity, their logos, et cetera, their colors, anything they want. We can do anything that you want to do. We can do heat transfers or direct printing.
Right.
And thousands of fabrics available to choose from.
Nice.
So we'll see. I mean, we see this as a transitional thing. It's not a long-term move. It's something for now. And to get us through this to the next thing. But it's also a way to, I mean, look, the masks are such a complex thing socially.
Yeah.
And if we can do something, you know, part of what's going on is they're anonymous, they're clinical.
Right.
Or they're homemade and maybe not great or not effective or not healthy even.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that you don't want to be breathing through polyester. You don't want that on your face. If you can have something that expresses your identity while it's covering your face, that's important.
Yeah.
You know, it's about personal expression. And so maybe we can, you know, it'd be great if we could move the needle a little bit on that.
Well, I thought it was a brilliant idea. And I think that was the, I mean, you and I have been chatting on Facebook, et cetera, for a while. But when you started talking about these masks, I was like, that's really cool. Because, you know, obviously, I mean, you've always been a designer. Like, you're one of the most design person I know. And when you always look for opportunities to design, and it doesn't have to be about architecture, it has to be about the need of something, right? Or the way that it fits through. And so you looked at this problem and you knew you had to deal with it, and you basically said, I can do this. And it's pretty amazing what you didn't just design this, you created an entire infrastructure from factory to deliverable systems all in one.
Look, really
in a very short time.
Robust.
Yeah.
Robust. And our company name is Lexington.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Lexington Shanghai and Lexington Houston now.
Mm-hmm.
And our tagline is do well by doing right.
Right.
Which I firmly believe, and all of us do. And so as we put all of this together, as we build the team, that's sort of the litmus test. Like, what are you in this for?
Right.
I mean, we do have to take care of ourselves. I've got bills to pay.
You know,
I'm not a nonprofit. I'm not pretending to be nonprofit.
Right.
But I want to contribute. I want to help. And when you start taking care of other people, amazing things happen.
Yeah. It's true.
If you're in it for yourself, it's very, it's a dead end, man. It's a dead end. It doesn't matter what you achieve.
Uh-huh.
It's empty in the final analysis. And I've really embraced this transformation, or this, you know, we're in a liminal period now.
Mm-hmm.
The old system, the old world is over, and we don't know what the next one is.
Right.
And that is the definition of a liminal time.
Right.
It's the time before the next thing.
Right.
And I am loving it. I mean, I feel a little guilty about saying that, because I know there's a lot of suffering. But look, I'm suffering too, and I'm embracing that.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that I never really have before.
Yeah.
I used to think, you know, it's very important to be thankful to have gratitude as one of your principal values and to practice that. And my mom, it's one of the things that she always would preach, you know, just be thankful. Because, look, man, the path that I've taken has been hard. I've been a self-employed designer my whole career, you know. The last time I worked in an office was 1988.
Right.
You know, when I got my degree, I just, you know, struck out on my own, and and I've, you know, I've made it this far without, you know, interruption.
Yeah.
And it's you know, in any creative field where you're making your own path, it's a tough one, whatever it is. Artist, musician, writer, the odds of success or, you know, financial stability are pretty low. There's usually the day job.
Well,
so,
I think
teaching helped me for sure.
Teaching is really a good thing. I mean, honestly, there's several things that I've learned. I mean, I was teaching at Rice briefly as well after I graduated, because I was one of the guys who knew the most of the software that was being used out there that no one else knew how to use. So I was like, yeah, Chris will do it. So, and it was actually, what was interesting about Rice, it was not uncommon for recent graduates to become teachers there. It was actually kind of hard to leave the school, because you sort of became part of it and part of that facility. And I'm not an architect anymore. I haven't been an architect for a long time, though my mother still calls me an architect because she doesn't understand what I do, so she still calls me an architect. But
you ever get licensed?
No. I was at Gensler, and then the first thing I did at Gensler is they made me in charge of all the 3D and the computer stuff, of course. So then I was like, well, that's what I do, I guess. But I've teaching was a big thing for me, because teaching allowed me, you know, if you teach something, you really got to know what you're talking about. And so therefore you start to learn a lot more than you think you did, than you think you knew about it by doing that. But honestly speaking, another reason we were talking about being on this podcast is that you have an idea of starting a podcast as well, which I think is a great idea. And I figured, why don't you come on this podcast and you can see what it's like. And then you can use that. But doing podcast itself has been a huge thing for me, because I learned so much from so many people. And the other thing that's incredible is I learned, just like it's happening today, I've known you for a long time, but I learned a lot more about you just because of the opportunity of you talking. So there's a great opportunity to learn from people by conversation and just finding out more about stuff. So,
yeah, I can't tell you how much I appreciate this.
Yeah.
I mean, this is... Look, I wanted to start a podcast for a couple of years.
And
even before, you know, I wasn't even following any. It was just something that I was interested in.
Uh-huh.
And really, I was thinking about swimming. There were swimmers that I wanted to talk to.
Okay.
Especially, you know, older swimmers. Like, how do you do it?
Right.
But it's evolved into so much more than that. And now, in the last few weeks with this time, I've started listening to podcasts and I'm just addicted.
Yeah.
I'm addicted. There's some great ones out there.
Oh, there's a lot. Like,
I love the Rich Roll podcast. That guy is somebody that I really identify with, really resonate with.
Okay.
I don't have the alcohol, but I'm familiar with it. You know, my brother has struggled with that his whole life. And so I can relate. But also, we all have addictions. We all have patterns.
Sure.
Of self-destructive or negative behaviors. And this medium is fantastic. I love the time to have an in-depth conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like this conversation has been all over the place, and I kind of apologize.
Don't apologize. That's the best part.
there were some ideas we sort of didn't get to.
I'll get back to them. I remember, so there was someone who's a neighbor of ours, and his son and my son were actually good friends. But it turns out that this guy his name is Wayne Knight, and he's the actor who plays Newman on Seinfeld, if you remember that, or he's also in Jurassic Park, etc. So he's a really really charismatic guy, really fun. And I got to know him, obviously, because our kids are friends. My you know, this is when they were little, so my son had no idea who his dad was. He just liked his house because he had a really big house. So we were hanging out, and he was talking stuff, and I talked to Wayne, and I said, I heard you on the Nerdist podcast. And he goes, yeah, I was on the Nerdist. He's like, I hadn't been on a podcast, and I'd never been on a podcast in my first time on. I said, yeah, it was really good. I learned so much about you. And he goes, you know, Chris, what's interesting is that I do a ton of interviews for, you know, whatever movie or sitcom, whatever. And they come in with these junkets and they're like, you got 3 minutes to say the same soundbite for everything. And they're like, oh, yep. I've got one story and it takes 30 seconds. So you prep that one story. But in a podcast form, he said, suddenly he's like, I told my entire life story in an hour and a half. And then suddenly, like, people know way more about me than they've ever knew. I was like, yeah, exactly. That's what I thought was so cool about it.
Yeah, including me. I was listening to your you were a guest. I can't remember his name. McAllen?
Alan McKay?
McKay. Yeah, Alan McKay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some of it I'd have no idea what you're talking about.
yeah.
Because it's such an insider kind of shorthand.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, it was very cool to get that perspective on you and what you've done. And, I mean, obviously you've been amazingly successful and are, you know, in the thick of it. And have just, you know, parlayed one thing into the next. It's very cool.
Well, I think
to see what you've done, but it's great to hear the podcast. It's 2 hours long, right?
Right.
Something like that. And yeah. There's just all kinds of great stories and tidbits and stuff. Some of it's about a lot of other people you've encountered, and
sure.
Some of it's just personal. It was cool because I was just looking for more CG Garage podcasts.
Right.
And I stumbled onto yours.
Oh, onto the Alan one. Yeah, actually, interesting. I just recorded another one with him. And so it's going to be on again. And I don't know whenever he releases his. But it's what's also interesting is, honestly, is there's a guy who I've met a few times. He's a really nice guy. He and I go to the same conference. And he got on the, he said, I need to talk to you about something technical. So he has some technical problem I need to solve. And I got on the phone with him. And he goes, you know, it's weird, Chris. It's like, I feel like I know everything about you. And therefore, you're like a really good friend of mine. But you're like, you don't really, I realize that all of this information I know from listening to your podcast. And I was like, yeah, that's a little awkward. But anyway, it was fun. Definitely fun to do that. But I do remember one of the things we talked about that we kind of like left open-ended was the Cube book. Let's talk about the Cube book.
Yes.
So I remember the chair was one thing. And I remember looking at pictures of chairs, and we'd love to have pictures of them to put up on the podcast page. But you created another part of a design exercise that involved a cube, right?
Yes. So before we leave the podcast thing,
yeah.
Thank you. Because this is you said we can kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
This experience has been such a springboard for me to learn what it is and how to do it. And I mean, I don't know how to do it yet, but I know how to set up to be a guest.
Yeah.
Just going through that exercise has moved me much closer to making this a reality. So thank you so much.
Oh, no problem.
It's just great. So I'm on my way. I'm going to do this. I've lined up a couple of guests already. I'm really excited.
So. Perfect. Well, I will help you set up like all the technical things and where you need to do, where you do your RSS feed and all of that information. There's stuff that I can help you out with. It's not a problem. So
thank you. Yeah. I mean, the Squadcast, just learning about Squadcast.
Squadcast is new. I learned about this because of the pandemic. Like I did, because I always did them in person. So I was like, oh, this is great. Squadcast is the perfect tool for me right now. And I'm going to continue using it. Yeah.
Yep. So I'm learning from the master. It's thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we all need that. And I think that that's a big part of what's going on now. So we can really help each other, you know, and advance things in a way that we weren't open to before.
Sure.
My old life is gone. We're completely embracing that.
Mm-hmm.
Completely. I'm so ready for things to be different. So, to go back to the cubes, it does kind of go back to the chairs, because one of the things that was really important about the chairs was it wasn't a model. It wasn't a abstraction. It wasn't a drawing of something that would never be realized. It was the thing itself. And I was treading in some kind of treacherous territory, because I don't like uncomfortable furniture. I don't like art furniture. And around that time, art furniture was a big thing. And it's just sort of, to me, it was like a way for people who weren't good enough artists to kind of dip their toe in that world. And then craftsmen that weren't very good craftsmen could get away with crappy craft by calling it art furniture.
Sure.
It just was compromised. And it just, you know, I don't like to trivial. So one of the, when I started on that project, one of the things that, the imperatives, I didn't have a lot of rules, but one of them was the chairs have to be more comfortable, at least as comfortable or more comfortable and functional when I'm done with them. Mm-hmm. As they were when I started. And they look terrifying. You know, I had, there's especially one of them, it's all metal kind of wrapping a child's chair. And it looks like a bear trap or something. I had to beg people to sit down in it. It's very comfortable, but it's like, no thanks.
Yeah.
To carry that story to the conclusion, that group, it's really a body of work. Four chairs that create they're each like a sentence that creates a paragraph.
Right.
So they belong together. Together there's a kind of a narrative that they don't communicate individually. And that group got bought by the SF MoMA. Mm. So they're in that permanent collection, and they've been shown a few times. So what's a little frustrating is once they're in a museum environment, then nobody can sit in them anymore. So I can't convince people that they're comfortable.
Right.
But, anyway, I was really intent on making the thing itself. So in our architecture curriculum, that was kind of a missing component to me, that we spent so much of our time working in abstractions that never get realized. And some of the way that Morphosis dealt with that was to invest so much in the process, in the material of production, that it almost didn't matter if the thing was realized or not. You have this body of work that's amazing. And
sure.
It runs parallel. It has the same kind of, in a way, the same kind of gravity as the final product. So that first year that I was teaching, I wanted to do an elective, a 3-hour course that was called Methods of Making. And it was about direct interaction with materiality and making the thing itself, not making a model, but it's the thing. So some of this was just maybe intuitive, but some of it was kind of blind luck. The first year that I taught it, the program was a 16-inch box made out of wood, and you could introduce other materials to it, and it had a drawer. So it was sort of almost a surrealist component to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it produced some really amazing work, but it also didn't accomplish what I was trying to, which was to really be super reductive and get down to the nitty-gritty of every single decision and the consequence of every decision you make, that it's registered there in the materiality of the thing.
Right.
Is it coherent or is it not? And so in architecture school, it's easy to say something and equate that with doing it. And there's a huge gulf between the two.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you say it and you can say it eloquently, it's convincing, and people think that you've done it and you can convince yourself you've done it. But I wanted to kind of create a situation where you couldn't do that, where the thing had to speak for itself, and it either stood or fell on its own merit by what it could say, what it could communicate without anybody explaining it. And that first exercise with the drawer, it kind of let it allowed too many escape routes. So the students were really conceptualizing and not really dealing with the details, the construction, the kind of the way things are really assembled in those details, mm-hmm. because it was about an idea, an idea that was kind of attached to this thing instead of something that was emanating from the thing. So I had to revise that. Even though I liked that project, I said, okay, I got to cut off all escape routes. So we ended up doing, there's three versions of the exercise. And the first one is 2x4s. So you just use typical 2x4s and mechanical fasteners, and you construct a cube that's 16 inches.
Hmm.
And the only real rule is no chemical fasteners are allowed, no glue.
So you, okay. have to,
you can do any kind of fastener that you want. You can create your own or whatever. Or you don't even need a fastener if you can figure out how something can kind of interlock and hold itself together.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next iteration is, so one of the things that you have to resolve is a 2x4 is a directional material.
Right.
It has a grain to it, cross-section, et cetera. It's fine when you kind of make a two-dimensional corner, but then when you add that third axis, things get complicated.
Right.
So there's a complexity built into it and a kind of asymmetry suggested by it. And these things ended up being like snowflakes. There's so many ways to solve this.
Mm-hmm.
And so many beautiful ways, right? And each one, you basically have to construct a language. There has to be a logic that carries all the way through it. So every time you make a connection, turn a corner, it has to be resolved, and that has to feed to the next corner and be resolved. And the whole form has to also be resolved. And when those things are in sync, when it's all in dialogue, it's stunning. And maybe one of them itself, kind of like a snowflake, maybe it's beautiful, but when you see a whole array of them and you see them all together, but when you see them as a collection of variations on this theme, they're really stunning. The next iteration is to add a skin to the frame. So these are basically like a frame that's open.
Okay.
And so we enclose the frame with plywood and drywall. So I was trying to introduce just this interaction with the materials that you're going to be dealing with when you start practicing, when you start building.
Mm-hmm.
These are the ubiquitous things. 2x4s, nails, screws, wire, drywall, plywood. And so how do you turn the corner? How do you negotiate how these things meet each other? And how do they communicate? How is that all resolved? And so the exercise is you have to, you know, it's a six-sided form. So you have to cover five sides and leave one side open. And then you have to use two materials. So it automatically introduces asymmetry to it. So it can't be just kind of a reflex.
Right.
And you've got complexity built into it. And then the third one is a real departure. And that was basically a 16-inch solid that you have to put two materials in a dialogue to create a solid block. And the idea is that anywhere you cut a section through that cube, through that solid, it would reveal that relationship.
Right.
It would be solid, and it would also tell you something about that dialogue. The dialogue between those two materials would resonate and make sense. And that one is like a curveball, because you've already gotten kind of assimilated to this process, a way of thinking, and then this is like completely different. The solid one, it's like poetry in a way when you've been, you know, writing nonfiction,
right?
And so I've tried it in different sequences, and actually I taught a fall semester at the University of Houston, and we did cubes,
right,
as a studio project. And I hadn't taught since 2007. Been a long hiatus. And I got invited to teach, and I don't know if you know Gail Borden.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was tenured at USC. He was he was like one of my students in 93 or 4.
Early on,
he was a sophomore studio. He was one of those students where it's like, you just stay out of the way, try not to screw him up.
Yeah, I remember.
You know, I want to say this. I wish I had done that with you. You know, I'm not a mathematician.
Right.
I didn't, we'll have to talk about that a little bit. But you know, the politics and everything and the whole experience of being thrown into that studio with Michael.
Yeah.
Was hard for everybody. You know, because he had expectations. He was going to teach his own studio. He came in with Lars.
Yep.
And I came in with Lars. And the way that happened was Lars was on my final review for the chairs.
Right. Yep.
And he went nuts. He went nuts.
Yeah, I could.
So he was the outside critic
who
could say anything he wants to say, where, you know, when it's part of your own family, when you're part of the school, everybody's reserved. They don't want to go overboard with praise.
Right.
He did not have that problem.
Nope.
He did not have that filter. He was just going, he was effusive. He was going crazy. And so he and I bonded over that. And then, you know, 3 years later, he called me up and he said, hey, you know, he got the dean position.
Yep.
And was moving from Berkeley. And he called me up and said, I want you to come teach. And I was like, okay, great. And he said, he came to Houston and I took him to a couple of projects that I was working on. And he was just flipping out. And he was like, oh, you got to run the shop. I want you to do this. I want you to do that. And I was like, hey, I also have a practice.
Right.
There's a limit to what I can take on. But he had all this stuff for me to do. And then crickets.
Yeah.
So that was like June or July, and then crickets. Like, what's going on here? Well, he ran into a lot of pushback from other senior faculty.
Huh.
You know, the established...
The postmodernists.
Regime there were not. there were...
Oh, yeah.
You know, Albert Pope was a big advocate of mine.
Yeah, well, yes. But he wasn't the kind that was wearing the bow ties with the round glasses.
No. And it's so weird. You know, like I said, they kind of quarantined me, isolated me in that studio. It's like, why? It's like they didn't want the school to know what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they didn't want me to have a final review.
It was
very weird.
Mm.
And Bill Sherman was my advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bill's great. But he wasn't going to fight for me, you know?
Right.
That's not his nature. So when there was this pushback about me presenting the work, I was just like, all right, screw it. I don't care. I'm out of here.
Right,
he was
right.
Like, no. You got to, you know, we'll do this. So we did have a final review.
And right.
Thankfully. I mean, it changed my life, right?
Yeah.
Lars was there. Lars asked me to teach.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very polarizing. And these were professors that I didn't even know. They'd never taught me. I never had them for a class. Never really spoke to them. They just had an opinion about me. And apparently that's very common.
Yep.
So it was a really challenging situation. I didn't ask to be put in the middle of that, but neither did Michael.
We were very different. I mean, I remember everyone talking about like your studio is so different. I was like, what do you mean you're not learning lettering every day? I was like, I don't need to learn lettering. Why do I need to learn lettering? I know my handwriting sucks, but so what? You know?
Well, because we're doing this podcast, of course, I've been looking back at that experience.
Yeah.
You know, what I was doing. And, you know, if I was teaching elementary school, I would have had more training.
Yeah.
As a teacher, I would have had to go through some kind of teacher training. When you're teaching at an elite university, it's like, hey, get in there and teach. Like, okay, how? What? I had no mentor.
Right.
It was a really weird situation. I mean, that's something that I really wish I'd had. I wish I'd had somebody to mentor me, to tell me, you know, kind of what this is about and how to do it, because I'm not a political creature. Well, I was never in it for that.
All of these things, it was interesting, you know, because I mean, now looking back at all those years and thinking about how it was for me, you know, I was very confused going into that school. I knew I had some knowledge, and I knew I had a good problem-solving skill, but I knew I was very confused about what to do in design school because I'd never actually been in design school. I went to art school. I mean, I did a little, you know, I'd had majored in art and math, so I had both, but it was very different. And, you know, obviously critiques in architecture school were very strong. But, you know, I go in there, and then all of a sudden Michael shows up. And Michael, a lot of fun, but he's starting to tell me things that's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. No idea what you're talking about. Because it was really hard for me to understand what he was saying. And it was like, oh, I need to educate myself more about architecture. And I started to understand a little bit more about it. But it was that point. It was like, he did say some really great things. And I really appreciated everything I was learning from him. But there was a lot of things that were like, I didn't understand how to do this or how to translate my idea into a design. And that's when you came into me. It was most of what I learned from you was you sitting at my desk for a couple of hours. And you would do that often time. I don't know if you know, if you remember that, but you would sit at my desk for like 2 hours and like, all right, there's something in your head and you're not figuring it. You've got some great things and you're not figuring out how to put it into a model or a drawing or whatever. And you were helping me break that down. And also, dude, like I was mentioning before, it was about crafting as well. You know, one of the things you taught me when I was struggling to draw, because I was drawing, you know, I take a 4B pencil stuff, and it's like, well, let's take that 4B and let's make it a 7 or 7H. No, you made me draw with a 7H or like a 9H pencil. And you made me draw that line like 6 times before it became a line. And then I started to really look at that line. It's like, oh, it's a much prettier line because I drew it 6 times. So all the little problems that are in the line, I go over it and over and over again. It was the most precise hand-drawn line I've ever done because it was drawn 7 times. And it made me much more thoughtful about that line that was being drawn. And you taught me how to draw that way. And I still draw that way. So, I still remember, like, you know, just really put thought into all the lines you put down. So it was a really good thing. I really appreciate
I'm thrilled to hear that you learned something from me.
I did. There's a lot I learned from you.
I mean, when you think about Michael and I were polar opposite.
Oh yeah,
ends of the spectrum,
that was a good thing.
It's great, except the way that they put us together was so competitive. You know, we were trying to occupy the same territory,
right?
And they were like putting two scorpions in a box. Like, you guys work it out. It's like, why would you do that to a new professor?
Right. And this was his first time,
you know,
at Rice,
and
too.
Michael, yeah, and Michael is a serious dude, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he's an academic, and I've never aspired to be an academic. Yeah. I was, you know, just swimming in different waters. And, you know, if I think that it worked out great. Now, Michael was very generous in listening to my ideas and coming, because we had to design the studio ourselves between us. We had to agree on what are we doing and find common ground. And so instead of so much finding common ground, we alternated. So he gave me a project and I gave him a project, you know, I supported his and vice versa.
Yep.
So I, you know, one of the first things we did was those objects that you had to manipulate.
Yeah. Yep.
Which is so confounding. You know, you have to really dig hard to find a way into these things. And, you know, and some of them are abject failures. That's just comes with.
I think it was a cube, actually. Now that I think about it, David, you had us designing a cube. It wasn't the same exact thing. It was something about a cube that we all had to design. And I remember what I did now. Oh, my God, that's all these memories are flying back. I remember specifically what I did is, because I kind of sucked at modeling and I had all these failures around me, I had all of this basswood that is all these scraps of basswood everywhere. And I kept them because of like, this basswood's kind of expensive. So I'm going to keep it. Somehow I'm going to turn it into something. Right. And so I took all this basswood and I made a cube out of chipboard. And then I took the basswood and I connected the cube with, like, made all these touch points around the cube that goes around it, and then I removed the chipboard. I removed the chipboard, and so the cube represented the void that was the inside there. And it was kind of like, oh, well, that was fun.
An aha moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
We also did the common objects, like tools. I think it was a tool. You had to pick a tool or something like that.
Yes.
And you had to manipulate it, transform it in some way.
Yeah. I think somebody I did an espresso machine. Remember that?
Yeah, like really, really hard one. Like I didn't know what to do with that one. somebody did a hammer.
Yeah.
Segmented it and then reassembled it with hinges.
Yes.
That was art. That was beautiful.
Yeah, and trying to use a hammer that has hinges.
Somebody took a shoe and did like a, you know, frog dissection.
Yes.
That was really cool too.
The hammer, I think, was Carrie Whitehead who did that one. I think she did that one.
Yeah.
And then we also did the
cool
other
to think about who was in that studio.
Yeah.
There's some pretty high powered people in that studio.
Nicola, who's now like a vice president is there, and Carrie, and then Larry Albert.
A lot of people that went on to teach, yourself.
Yeah.
And Keith Koski, wasn't he in
that? Yeah.
It was a great group. And you guys, it wasn't easy for you to negotiate that, to navigate through what you were in for, especially as an incoming student. That's hard enough to kind of get your footing.
It was 14 of us. I mean, that's the thing that was kind of amazing about Rice, is that if you think about a class that's coming into grad school and there's only 14 of you.
And you've got two professors.
And you got two professors, right? And they're both the professors are young. Right, you were both 32.
It wasn't a hierarchy. It wasn't like one of us was the assistant.
In fact, Keith Koski was older than both of you guys at the time.
Right.
And so, it was like, and the way I looked at it, I was like, look at all of us. We're all different and unusual students. It almost felt like we were at a reality show, like the way, like cast us for a reality show. So
Yeah. That's the way Andy put your studio together, right? Andy was still involved.
He might have.
Admissions. But the whole idea of that program was to put together 12 or 14 students from diverse backgrounds.
Right.
Where everybody knew a lot about something, but maybe nothing about architecture.
Right.
And some people did, you know, had art history degrees and, you know,
right,
architecture history degrees. They knew way more. I didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another thing, is that I came into that program with zero experience. I was an artist. I didn't have any art history background, or I was just kind of self-taught and had worked at an illustrator and that kind of stuff. I was always an artist growing up, but I had no formal training and I didn't know anything about architecture history or anything. And I get kind of thrust into that environment where that's all the stuff you need to know.
Right.
For one thing, it was fantastic to be introduced to art history. I just loved it. Loved it.
Yeah.
To be introduced at that point in my life was such a, you know, revelation. Architecture, not so much. I mean, it's so funny. I was going through old drawers and files recently and found Andy's original handout for this is what, you know, the studio is. These are the tools and equipment you're going to need for day one.
Mm-hmm.
And basically giving you a reading list. I never read those books. I still haven't read any of those books.
Right.
I try and I can't. I love to read, but I don't read fast, and mm-hmm. I kind of savor what I read, and I like to enjoy it. If it's technical, I kind of read the same sentence over and over, and I just don't like architectural writing. I mean, maybe somebody could show me something that is engaging, but I just, trying to force feed that stuff, I just couldn't do it. So it really put me in this weird position where I had no experience and I was sort of designing intuitively. And then it's like, okay, you need to come and teach, and no direction on how to be a teacher or anything like that. And also I'm in this environment where it's academia. You know, your rhetoric is the currency.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a really weird position where I had very little confidence and also a lot of confidence, and it's kind of the things I had confidence in weren't really valued, you know, they didn't fit that system.
Right.
At the same time, they were recognized as something. I mean, the people that talk about making always envy the makers.
Right.
you know, when it comes down to it, it's about the things you make, not right. the things you say about those things, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, without those things, there's nothing to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So that first year teaching your studio, I mean, I just wish I could go back now and have yeah. that experience again. I would be a different person. And it's so funny to hear your experience with Michael, because I thought you and Michael, like, 100% connected and resonated. Like,
I love talking to him, but it was just like I didn't understand what he was talking yeah. about, and yeah. it took a long time. And then I got it, and he and I really did get along. You know, it's funny. I ran into him. It was a couple of years ago, actually. I was at Tesla. At their design headquarters, and I talked to those guys there, and then suddenly I see at the reception waiting for my it's like, that looks like Michael Bell. And so I go and I hear his voice, and it's like, that's totally, and I go up to him, it's like, excuse me, are you Michael Bell? And he goes, yeah, I was listening to you. You look real familiar too. I said, I was one of your students at Rice University, first year at Rice. And he goes, right, you're the guy who was always using the computers. Yeah, it's like, yep, that was me. And he goes, I remember you. And I was like, yeah. And so I talked to him. So yeah, it was funny. It was, and Tom Main has been there too, because Tom Main, apparently they're, Michael and Tom have been helping with the design process at Tesla, apparently. So I don't know what they're doing, but it's great. It's great.
That's very cool. I mean, I wish that I had, if I could do it again, what I would do in those crits sitting at your desk, I would be listening. I'd be like, plumbing the depths.
You spent hours with me at my desk, because I remember us very much. Michael was having a hard time communicating what he was trying to communicate to me. He knew something was there, and then I think you helped me figure it out. And I think what we ended up doing, I remember what the project was. The project was, we had to represent some great piece of architecture, right? And I think Carrie was doing the Palladio, or which are the what's the famous little Italian, what to call it, anyway, I decided to do Frank Gehry's Vitra Design Museum. And because, similar to you, I just sort of fell in love with deconstructivism at that time. I just thought it was amazing. And so I was looking at, how the hell am I going to build this? And you were telling me, it's like, well, it's not just about building it. You have to learn something about it. And so we were learning about it, and I was looking at all the pictures and understanding about it. And I said, the problem I always had with this building is that, or not the problem, is that the problem with the building is that people always see it from the outside as a sculpture. And they don't see the beauty of the inside of it, because the beauty of the inside is so hard to understand, because it's so deconstructed, right?
You have to experience it.
Yeah. And so you and I discussed that for a long time, and then figure it out. And then that's when I decided to build the entire thing inside out. I don't know if you remember when I did that, but basically I took a piece of plywood and I did I was trying to figure out, like, I want to represent the inside and how to do that. And I think you were the one who showed me, like, you ever heard of a reflected ceiling plan? So what we did a 3D version of a reflected ceiling plan, where you go, basically you're looking inside the building from above. And it was a really great idea for us to sort of, you know, brainstorm that conceptual design.
That's a very, very Morphosis approach.
Yeah. I didn't know, right? But I learned so much from that, right? So it was a really great sort of idea of doing that. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. I highly recommend
it. You had a good experience.
I felt like I
missed an opportunity to engage you on your level, to learn from you. I mean, I think that I've learned to do that much more now with students. But I think early on, I was so close. I was really young, and. Yeah.
We were all young.
Yeah, you're trying to, well, you have an age, but we're trying to, find the right distance.
Yeah.
The right kind of intimacy without being too close. And also I had this insecurity. I mean, I was in this situation where everybody in the room knew more than I did, but I was the teacher. Yep. That's a tough one. I had a couple of studios where there were students that rubbed my face in that, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And that, sorry, they told me to come and teach, or they asked me to
right
take it up with somebody else. But you know, I'm not sure what I could do in that situation. But it's kind of taken a long time for me to, I mean, in fact, at Rice, I was never at home.
Right.
I never felt part of, even when I was tenure track, when they hired me tenure track, it was like this, we had this party and it was fantastic. And mm-hmm. I felt so much support, and it was, the atmosphere is like about time, you know,
right.
This is great. But it quickly dissipated, dissolved, and I just felt like I was always on the outside looking in.
Mm.
And I didn't speak the same language. And, you know, I'm here to develop my voice, my point of view, not to try to fit into something else that's not, doesn't come natural to me. So much effort to try to do that, and then what do you end up being? I mean, there's already somebody else who is that naturally. Why, you know?
Right.
I just wanted to be me. And yeah. They kind of took me aside and gave me a warning. And I, you know, there was politics. There was an undercurrent of politics yeah. going on. And there was one person in particular that just never wanted me to be on the faculty.
Hmm.
And he's pretty Machiavellian. Knew how to wait, you know, for his opportunity to take me out.
And mm-hmm.
anyway, they kind of pulled me aside and they said, you know, your studios need to do this or that. And I've been doing the same thing for 15 years. It's like, is there a problem with, nobody's ever said, I can see the work. Everybody can see the work coming mm-hmm. out of the studios.
Yep.
There's a problem. Anyway, mm-hmm. I was sort of given a warning. And mm-hmm. so it's like, okay, I better play by the rules here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Katrina had come through. And I had gone back and forth to New Orleans to really, I didn't trust the kind of media accounts of what reality was. So I took trips over there and really explored the Ninth Ward, all of that stuff. And, you know, that was weighing heavily on me. I really wanted to do something with New Orleans. And I was mm-hmm. really kind of offended at the architectural community's response to that situation, which was to have design competitions and turn it into a self-promotion
yep.
Opportunity where it's like just doing designer stuff for New Orleans. It's like that. It has nothing to do with New Orleans. It has nothing to do with a solution to what the real problems are. You don't even know what the problems are. How are
right.
you proposing a solution? So the next fall, after I'd been kind of told I needed to toe the line, I proposed a studio that was research. And it's like, we're going to, before we presume to have an answer or propose an answer, it was a housing project for New Orleans. Before mm-hmm. we propose an answer, let's make sure we know what the problem is. Let's have the right questions first.
Right.
And maybe the semester it's going to be entirely research. Maybe we won't get to a point where we do a proposal. And I'm okay with that if that's where it goes. And so I have, I think, 8 students
mm-hmm.
sign up for that. And it was so much fun. It was just a blast. And it was sort of like the international studio we had.
Right.
Student from Korea, from China, from Mexico. A guy from, well, he's born in America, but his recent roots were Kenya. He had a right. deep interest in reconnecting with Kenya. And so we had this really, it was Frank Guittard. There were some great people in that studio. And I decided I'm going to run this studio like an office. So everybody's going to have their own area of research, and I'm just going to kind of direct it.
Right.
And it was great. I mean, we had, anyway, we produced a book, and the book was called NOLA Macroscape. And then the next semester I did a vertical studio, an undergrad studio. So that's juniors and seniors combined. And we were going to do a guitar factory. And do you know Collings Guitars out of Austin?
Mm-mm.
So Bill Collings passed away, unfortunately, from cancer recently, a few years ago.
Okay.
But he's a world-renowned guitar maker. And based in Austin, like, virtually everybody who's anybody has at least one of his guitars.
Okay.
You know, you name it. Pete Townsend. I mean, you name it. They have this Collins guitars. And one of my good friends is a general contractor, and he built the new factory. So they had built up from nothing in this sort of ramshackle accreted thing, and had reached a level of success where they were going to build a state-of-the-art factory. So I had access to the drawings, to the facility and the process and everything. So it was like the perfect, to me, that's the perfect design project for juniors and seniors. So there's so many levels you can address the process and fabrication and construction and order, math, music. And I had this idea I was going to do that in the spring. And one day in the fall, I was in front of my house out in the front yard, and somebody called out my name. And this guy was walking by, and he was like, "Hey, are you David?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I'm Steven. I live down the street." And he knew, he wasn't an architecture student, but he knew somebody who I had taught. We had a mutual friend. And he said, "I'm a luthier, and he lives like five houses down from me." And I'm like, "Wow, I'm doing a guitar factory studio next semester. Would you be interested in getting involved?" And he was like, "Yeah." So Stephen Marchione is a world-class luthier. His guitars are $35,000 or,
oh my gosh,
more. He's like the real deal. The luthier is an instrument maker, like a violin maker or guitar maker.
Right.
So I have off and on played guitar since I was a teenager. I never knew anything about them. I also didn't know anything about music.
Right.
I'm starting to hear myself hear a theme here. Like I do all these things that I don't really know anything about.
Right.
But anyway, we embarked on this studio, and it was sort of like the Wood Institute competition where you can't start the project because it's the Watkin Prize. There was a schedule that you had to adhere to. So the first couple of weeks were pre-design, so we could do research and analysis but not actually start the project. So I brought him in, and we made a single string instrument, and it was a you know, so they had to make the frets just like the nut and the bridge, and a tuning key, just a piece of wood. They could do anything they wanted, and I'd had very low expectations. It was just like a sign on Friday, due on Monday project. I was blown away. These things were amazing. Mm-hmm. So we were like, okay, maybe we should do a three-string instrument, because then you have a triad, you have a chord, you can actually make music.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we were doing a lot of analysis, instrument analysis, the proportional studies and all of that. And I was just blown away by what I was learning. The iconic instruments like the Stratocaster, the electric guitars, even the acoustic instruments, all of these beautiful iconic designs are just infused with proportions that are easily analyzed. They're not subjective,
right?
And they come from the proportions of the musical scale. And so all this stuff was super interesting. And, you know, like, how does music work, and how can that kind of be translated into an idea of architecture, of proportionality and rhythm and repetition,
right,
structures of things. We got a little further down this path, and I was like, you know, what is the most reasonable instrument that we could make? And so Stephen and I brainstormed and came up with the mandolin.
Okay.
A guitar, it's just a question of real estate. These are hand carved. And this is something I didn't know. Do you know what an archtop guitar is?
Mm-mm.
It has a bow on the top.
Okay.
It's curvilinear, right? Like a violin. A violin has a topography.
Yes, yes, yes.
Right? It's not just flat. That, I thought that was like, molded, you know, like an Eames chair.
Yeah, 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 right.
No, it's carved. Okay. So you take a slab of wood and you carve that topography, and then you do the backside, and you have to do it in a way that you don't cut all the way through.
Right.
And also make it so thin that it resonates, but not so thin that it collapses or breaks. But anyway, we hit on this idea of doing a mandolin because it's small.
Mm-hmm.
A guitar is it's a lot of carving. Mm-hmm. It takes forever. It's so much more work.
Right.
And it's all a question of hours, you know, just what it takes to carve that many more square inches or square feet of material. Yeah. So we put it to a vote, sat all the students around. We had 11 students. We sat them around a table and said, okay, I have this idea. What if we made a real instrument? What if we made a mandolin? It may take up the whole semester. We may not do a project, like a standard project. We may not do the factory. We may run out of time.
Mm-hmm.
But who's down for that? And it was 100% raised hands. They all wanted to do it. So off we went. And it was so cool to kind of reimagine a studio, a design studio. And Stephen wasn't paid, wasn't officially recognized by the school or anything. He came to every studio session.
Right.
3 days a week, brought his tools, and he taught step by step how to do this. So they built their instruments from scratch. The only thing that we bought was the necks, the blank necks.
Okay.
So they had like a generic headstock, just like a slab, you know, rectangle. So they got to design their headstock, but they had to fret the necks. They had to cut the necks to length and mount the necks.
Hmm.
But the rest of it, they built from scratch. So they bought slabs of wood. They had to split the wood to make it book match, glue those up, carve the, you know, carve everything. They had to bend the sides. They had to plane the thickness down to like a little more than a 16th of an inch, less than an eighth of an inch. And then with a heat bender, bend the sides and glue everything up. It was just amazing. So I was the design critic and he was the technical instructor. And one of the things that I said, we're going to get rid of everything that's not essential in this room. All of your crap from last semester is out of here. All of it gone. So I ran it like they ran the machine shop when I did my chairs. Like the guy was from the Navy and everything had to be absolutely ship shape or you didn't come back. If you left a mess, that was your last time in the shop.
Yep.
So, and everything had to be put back where it belonged because those tooling, if you can't find your tooling, you can spend all day looking for the right bit or something. So everything had to stay organized and neat. And so that's what we did with the studio. It's like everything that's not necessary, that doesn't apply to what you're actually doing, get it out of here. And we're going to clean the studio every day. We're going to sweep the floors every day. And so we did most of the work in the studio.
Hmm.
There was some work that was done down in the shop, but they each built their own kind of work board that would hold the instrument while they worked on it. And most of the work was actually done in the studio. And it was just unbelievable. It was such an amazing experience. And I was sort of the documentarian. I just photographed and videoed kind of constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of documentation of this. And then we did some really nice photo documentation of the final product.
Mm.
But that was the last thing that I taught at Rice. It did not go over. They were like, we don't do that here.
Right. That's a shame.
And it was really weird because we connected with this website called Mandolin Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you can imagine, there's a bubble for everything. And
sure.
So there's a huge world of mandolin that, like, unless you're in that world, you don't know about it.
Right.
And early on, we found this website, and that was just the epiphany. That was just like mind blown. The beauty of the mandolin as opposed to something like the violin is freedom.
Hmm.
Design freedom. So the mandolin is basically a violin. It's the same string length, same tuning. It has twice as many strings or doubled up, like has the same basic volume, same scale length. So, you know, you're basically making a violin. either make a violin or you don't. Mm-hmm. It's such a tradition that it leaves no room for creativity. But what we found out with the mandolin was you can do anything you want because nobody owns it, nobody cares. There's no tradition. And when we found this website, we found that every imaginable guitar has been turned into a mandolin. Double neck flying V is a mandolin. All these electric mandolins.
Yeah.
You know, Les Paul, Telecaster, Stratocaster, everything has been turned into the mandolin scale.
Interesting.
And then you look at acoustic mandolins. You can do anything you want. There's some beautiful, beautiful things out there. So that really inspired us, inspired the students, and they just took off. So we ended up with 11 unique instruments that were all successful. Word had kind of spread through the campus. A couple of people, or at least one of the students in the studio, had a roommate. He was in Shepherd School, the music school.
Mm-hmm.
So word had kind of spread through campus. So when we had our final review, first we had a roundtable discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just turned into a jam session. And we had people from every department in the university there.
Hmm.
Just to be part of it. And the students were, you know, these things are, they've had so many hours and suffering invested in these things. It's hard work. There were so many blisters.
Yeah.
Sore shoulders. It's hard. And also they're fragile. It's every step of the process of making these things is potentially catastrophic.
Right.
It risks everything you've done before. Imagine working on CG and knowing that if you make the wrong move, it's going to erase the whole thing.
Right.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
I was terrified. I tried not to show it because the students didn't show any fear at all.
Right.
But I was like, oh my God. So even think about the last step. The last step is when you tune it.
Right.
So that's when you're, I think it's 200 pounds of string tension. And this is a delicate, fragile, it's an eighth of an inch at the thickest and half of that the thinnest. And you're going to load that up with 200 pounds of tension. It really wants to just implode.
Right.
You don't know what you have this whole time. You've invested all this time and you don't know if you have something or not until you put the strings on and tighten them.
Yeah.
And it survives.
And the structure of it too.
That's what I mean. Yeah, it is a structural thing. And the reason why I believed in it so strongly as belonging in the architecture curriculum is because it is structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also minimum structure. It's kind of like Bucky Fuller's ultimate goal,
right,
which is infinite span, zero mass,
right,
and or zero weight, whatever. And so you're making these delicate things that resonate, and you put bracing in them very strategically so it doesn't kill the resonance.
Right.
But it also is structurally sound.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fantastic experience. And, you know, I was looking forward to doing more, doing like a percussion studio.
Right.
And involving the studio, kind of recruiting. I wanted to have more cross-pollination. I could see the potential across campuses that all these silos don't communicate. And it's like, man, what are we doing? You know, you leave here and then you wish you could talk to those people.
Right.
And collaborate. And there's so much room, there's so much potential to collaborate, but people are protective of their turf and scared to take those risks.
Yeah.
So that was the end of my tenure at Rice. And then it was a long time before I taught again. I just didn't want to do it for a long time.
Well, it's a shame because you were a great teacher. I honestly thought it was very interesting. And I thought, honestly, you know, yes, it was clear that both you and Michael were thrown into that situation. It was very interesting. But I took it to benefit, right? I took the best out of both of you to figure out how to get to where I wanted to go. So that's what I wanted to
good
do.
For you there. Yeah. I mean, there was that opportunity.
Yeah,
it's interesting, the last couple of years, because of the mandolin studio, I mean, even though that was, you know, more than 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a couple of things. One is, when those things were done, those students had their confidence was sky high.
Right.
They were way more skilled than I am.
Right.
One of them, we crossed paths in the hallway one day, and he said, hey, we stopped, and he said, hey, you know, I feel like I can do anything. It's like, yeah, you can. I mean, look. I would walk in and find these pieces that they'd made, like an ebony bridge or tailpiece, just gorgeous. Like, where did you get this? I made it. Like, no. Really? Yeah. That's amazing. So I would really, I mean, one of the things that I thought also thought validated it was, you know, they bought little cases for their instruments.
It's right.
Like if a student, a recent graduate walked into my office for an interview and dropped that on my desk, I'd hire them in a heartbeat.
Right.
Like, okay, this tells me so much.
Right.
Not only is it an original design, but the execution of it, the skill, the discipline, wow. Mm. Okay. I can use you somehow.
Right.
So I really am trying now to circle back around and get in touch with those students and find out. That would be an interesting podcast.
Yeah.
Like, how did that influence you?
Yeah.
How did that change your path?
For sure. Well, listen, David, I actually have to get going soon, but I really appreciate you giving the time to do this, and great stories about design and your influences and your philosophy, because I think that's something that has always been very interesting to me. So I'm really happy to do that. Congratulations on starting the company and you know, doing the masks, which is incredible as well. And all the great things you've been doing. So it's awesome to do this. And I definitely look forward to hearing about your podcast. Have you come up with a name yet for your podcast or not yet? Are you still brainstorming?
Well,
that one?
When I was thinking about swimming, I wanted to call it There's More to Swimming Than Life.
Uh-huh.
But now I want to talk about more things. I don't want to get pigeonholed into one subject. And that's something that maybe we'll talk about later. It's like,
sure.
You know, how do you kind of frame it so that you don't get stuck, because there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. Or you can have different podcasts. I have two podcasts.
Okay.
So you can do that too.
But thank you so much. And I hope somebody gets something out of it.
I'm sure they will. I know they will.
Just talking.
I know I have, so I know other people will as well.
Man, I've enjoyed the heck out of it and spending time with you. This is... it's just such a privilege. I really appreciate it.
It's fun, right? It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's fun to listen to them too when they're good.
That's so going
to
be good.
Hopefully this is one of those.
All right. Well, thank you, David.